Welcome, everybody. We'll formally start here. This is Ben Dean with MentorCoach and Coaching Toward Happiness. It's Thursday, July 14th, 2011, and we are looking forward to our conversation tonight with Derek Sitters. As I was saying, we're pleased to announce the Foundation's Coach Training Program coming up with Anne-Marie McKelvey on Wednesdays at noon Eastern, beginning 7-2011. Then this conversation with Derek is one of a continuing series of interviews with thought leaders in positive psychology, coaching, and the related professions. On July 29th, we'll host Gretchen Rubin, president of the Yale Law Review, clerk to Sandra Day O'Connor, and author of the Happiness Project that many of you know. On August 26th, Jamie Pennebaker, professor and chair of the psychology department at University of Texas at Austin, who has done much of the important work on the power of writing and its impact on your emotions. He has a forthcoming book that will be published in August called The Secret Life of Pronouns. On September 30th, we will have the world's leading expert on self-regulation, Dr. Roy Baumeister, Francis Epps Eminent Scholar at Florida State University, who will be launching a new trade paperback, Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. On August 24th, we will have perhaps the world's leading authority on goal attainment, Peter Gulwitzer of NYU, whose most recent book is the Oxford Handbook of Human Action. During this call, this is really important, if you have questions for Derek, email them to me. So write this down right now so you'll be ready to go. Email them to me at bendeanphd@aol.com. bendeanphd@aol.com, and in the subject line put in all caps Derek Sitters, and then your name, and then a succinct question, and you can put who you are and so on in the body. And I'll do my best to get all the questions to Derek. Today, it's my great pleasure to introduce Derek Sitters. You've all read his bio. You've all seen his videos. I'll just say he graduated from the Berklee School of Music in 2.5 years, was a successful singer-songwriter, formed CD Baby when he couldn't find anybody to sell his music online. Some friends asked to if he would sell theirs too, and it really took off. And 10 years later, he was serving a humongous number of clients worldwide, decided to sell it for $22 million, giving most of the money to charity. He continues with many projects. He has a new best-selling book called Anything You Want, 40 Lessons for a New Kind of Entrepreneur, which is one of the reasons for our conversation tonight. He lives with his wife in Singapore and is calling in from Singapore, where it is 8 minutes after 8 in the morning. So, Derek, welcome to the call.
Thanks, Ben. And by the way, I just have to pass everybody a sincere apology. I'm glad you mentioned I was in Singapore. I was actually so excited to do this call with you. And I'm not just saying this. I woke up at 5:30 this morning, just like bounced out of bed, like cool. I was really looking forward to this call. But because it was 5:30 in the morning, I thought, oh well, I've still got 2.5 hours to go. So how about I do a little work? And then I just got wrapped up in my work, and then sorry, I'm a few minutes late.
Well, I'm glad you. Was what prompted you to come getting my email?
Yeah,
you noticed the time. Okay, so well, I'm glad you made it. So, and there's so many places to start, and I will get to the book and to many of the questions that people have on the list. I know one of the reasons a lot of people are excited to talk to you is because they're assuming that you know something about virtual marketing and how to you have some opinions on how to infuse your ideas and get them out to the world, and that's something they're interested in. But just for starters, one of the questions I would have is, was there anything in your childhood or when you were growing up that that suggested that you might be a great entrepreneur?
Of course not. No, I think that I've always been obsessive is the wrong word because that makes it sound bad, but I get really into one thing at a time. I I have a long attention span, and I really like to focus on things. I think it's the opposite of ADD or whatever the current term is. That when I was a little kid, I had a cat, and I got really into cats. And soon I was making all of my art projects at school were cats, and every time we would write a short story, I would write it about cats. I'm talking, you know, I was like age 7, 8, 9. Mm-hmm. And apparently it was so bad that my teacher actually called my parents in to say, you know, I think little Derek might have a problem here. He's completely obsessed with cats. And my parents said, oh, that's just the way he is. And so that lasted a few years, and I got completely obsessed with computers for a couple of years. Then I got completely obsessed with music, and that one lasted 15 years. And then when I started CD Baby, it was just because I guess I'd been doing nothing but music for 15 years, and all of a sudden I had to make a website, and I just dove in and got fascinated again. So I guess I still kind of find this trait in myself that I tend to dive in deeply to things.
Okay, and is your dad an entrepreneur as well?
No, actually, he's a particle physicist.
Okay, and is he connected with the university or...
A few. Let's see. Well, now he's in Portland, Oregon, not affiliated with any university. But like, I was born while he was at Berkeley, California, and then we went out to Argonne National Labs in Chicago, and he was doing particle physics for 20 years, actually, until my grandfather died, and he had to take over the family business. So he's kind of, I think he and I got into the business side of things about the same time. But I didn't come from a business-minded family. No,
mm-hmm.
I think I just kind of came from a family that gave me lots of room to dive into whatever interested
mm-hmm.
me.
And what is your family business?
Now it's real estate. So if
okay.
you go to, like my website is Sivers.org, but if you go to Sivers.com, you'll see my dad's family's website. I made the website for them. They do industrial real estate up in Portland, Oregon.
Okay, great. Okay, and so I was struck by you talk some of the time in interviews as if you never really had a goal with where CD Baby particularly wanted to go. Everything just kind of unfolded. But it did sound like when you were 14 and afterwards, you had a real goal or a vision of being a great singer and a musician that kind of drove you. Was that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think that probably what got me onto my very kind of workaholic path was that thing at 14, 15 when I decided I want to be a musician. And it wasn't just that I wanted to be a rock star. I wanted to be a professional musician, like whatever that took, whether that meant I was going to be a music teacher or a record producer or something. I knew that I wanted to make my living doing music. And I knew that if I worked really, really, really hard, I could do it. That it wasn't anything to do with luck. And so I think I just got into that kind of achievement mindset where it's like every day I was just going to bounce out of bed ready to work as hard as I could to make my dreams come true. And, you know, if you get into that mode starting at 14, 15, 16 or so, then you can apply that approach to other things. So at the age of 29, 30, when I kind of changed my approach from my music to helping other people with their music, it didn't feel like that much of a change. Do you know what I mean? It was still that
mm-hmm.
I was taking the same approach. I was just working on slightly different things.
And I heard you say someplace that when you hit about the age of 28 or 29, you really kind of found your voice and you really loved, you know, really liked the way you sounded as a solo singer. And someone commented that, you know, some people either have that or they don't have that. And, you know, on the other side of the argument is the 10,000-hour rule that Malcolm Gladwell has talked
yeah.
about. What do you think of that 10,000-hour rule and how it is applied to you?
It, well, if you don't mind me quickly retelling the story, it's what Ben's talking about is that at that same age, at about 14, 15, I decided I wanted to be a singer. And people often think of singing as just something that you either have it or you don't. And I didn't at the time, but I was convinced that I could if I kept practicing. So for hours a day, for every day, for years on end, for about 15 years, I would practice singing, I would do gigs, I would say yes to everybody who had any kind of singing opportunity. And after about 15 years of doing that, I got pretty good at singing. So, of course, it's funny, you know, when you read something like Outliers and they say it takes about 10 years. And I guess any of us can look back at anything that we've done for 10 years and kind of nod and say, yeah, I guess it did take about that long. But what hit me stronger, though, was Carol Dweck's work about that kind of the fixed versus growth mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, to me, singing especially is something that seems like such a clear example of that. Even if somebody feels that, yes, with hard work I can become a better dentist, they think, well, singing, come on, that's just, you either have it or you don't. It's like you're either tall or you're short. But that's why singing was an interesting one to challenge that on, that really if you just keep practicing, you can get really, really good. And maybe because I just coincidentally tackled that one from an early age, it got me into a really good mindset to know that, you know what, anything you want to do in life, just a matter of practice. There's no such thing as like, oh, well, I'm just not good at that.
And during those 15 years, well, tell people real briefly, why did you decide to get through college so fast, and how in the world did you get through a school like Berkeley in, you know, in under 4 years? Like, what happened with that?
Well, I met a teacher just 6 months before I went off to school. I had been accepted to Berklee School of Music, but it was a few months before I had, was setting off to go. And I met a music teacher in Chicago named Kimo Williams that used to teach there. And so when he heard I was going there, he gave me this knowing look, and he said, I have a theory. I think I can, with the right training, I can help you graduate in 2 years. And he said, come by my music studio tomorrow morning. And I came by his studio, and he just sat me down for this really intense music theory lesson. It reminded me years later, if you've seen that movie, The Matrix, where, you know, they're training Neo, and all of a sudden they're just like, they plug something into the back of his head, and he goes, whoa,
mm-hmm.
I know Kung Fu.
Mm-hmm.
So Kimo sat me down and he said, okay, pay attention, I'm going to teach you everything about music theory right now. Okay, this is a major scale. This is the first note of the scale. What is the E? What is that? In a C scale, what is that? The third note of the scale. Okay, great. If you build a triad, what's a triad? This and that. If you build a triad off this E, what is that? What kind of chord does that get you? A minor chord. That's right. So a three chord is a minor chord. Why? Because it's built on the third note of the scale. So he just, at that kind of intensity for 2 hours, he basically taught me an entire semester of music theory at Berklee School of Music.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did that over the course of about 9 lessons only, I think, that summer. And I went to my first day of Berklee School of Music, and they have the entrance exams. And that's when I found out, yeah, that what he had taught me in those 9 lessons was basically, I think, something like 8 semesters of music theory, arranging, harmony. He had taught it to me just in this, with this intensity. His theory was that classrooms are always kind of kept at the speed of the slowest student because they need everybody to keep up. And he said, but if you're bright and if you're focused and if you're wanting to learn, you can learn 10 times faster than that if you've got a one-on-one situation. So then he just kind of gave me some real mottos in life about saying, like, never accept the speed limit. Like, the standard pace is for chumps, is what he would say. Don't accept their speed limit. They say it takes 4 years to graduate college. Just take that as a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of got me into that mindset for everything else in life.
Okay. So was that 2.5 years, was that going year-round, summers also?
Yeah. So he was actually slightly disappointed. It means that I essentially graduated in 3 years, if you count my 2 summer semesters. Actually, no, let me think about it. I guess I only did 1 summer semester, but it's funny. Other people were congratulating me, and he said, oh, well, we'll try harder with my next student.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was pretty amazing, having taken 5 years for me to go through undergraduate school. So I think that was cool. So, and then one more question before I get to CD Baby, which would be, what was your dream, of, if you had one, of what you wanted to be as a musician, and how close did you get to it? Like, did you have a dream of being on the Johnny Carson show, or of, you know, headlining for somebody, or having a really large following. I know you did a lot of college gigs, but what was your dream that you were chasing?
Yeah, absolutely. As you describe, I was chasing the big, giant rock star cover of Rolling Stone kind of dream.
And, okay.
So I didn't get... I guess I got just far enough that I learned a lot, and I was happy with what I had done. I mean, in some ways, I was living at least one version of the dream. It's a little bit of that, like, what do you say, shoot for the stars and reach the moon kind of thing, where I was making my full-time living just doing music. I mean, last time I had a job, like a boss, was 1992. I quit my job and was just making a living in New York City as a full-time musician,
mm-hmm.
touring, producing people's records and playing on people's records. And I even bought a house in Woodstock, New York, just with the money mm-hmm. I made touring. So I was really proud of myself. I was really happy and satisfied. I mean, I still wanted more. I wanted to be a giant rock star.
Mm-hmm.
But then, honestly, when CD Baby just kind of happened, and it's funny, kind of metaphorically, it's a little bit like having a baby where some of us have a kid that wasn't planned and you go, oops, oh, okay, this is my new reality. So I kind of accidentally birthed CD Baby, and I was really glad that it took me off that track because I used to work at Warner Brothers Records Music in New York City, and I met a lot of miserable rock stars, and I think a lot of them set out with those kind of teenage dreams of rebellion, thinking that to be a rock star was the coolest job in the world. But once they got into it, they found that, no, actually, it could be a really bad job because you think as a teenager, when you think of the life of a rock star, you don't think that you'll have a boss. But once you get into it and you sign a record deal with EMI or Sony or Warner Brothers, you do have a boss, and it's some guy at the record label telling you what you can and can't do with your music. And then I'd meet these rock stars who would kind of come into the office, and I ran the tape room, so my room was actually kind of the place that they could go to get away for a second if they had some high-powered meeting with one
mm-hmm.
of the executives, and I was the tape room guy, so sometimes they'd just kind of escape into my room and we'd get to talk candidly. And a lot of them expressed that it was really sad or annoying, the fact that they made an album of 13 songs that they loved, that felt was their artistic creation, and they wanted to put it out into the world, and the record label said, no, we don't hear a hit, keep writing, we're not letting you put that out, because we own you, we gave you that advance, and that's why all of your rights belong to us, and we choose what to put out in your name. And all of a sudden, I guess I could say during my 20s, during pursuing this dream along the way, I kind of realized that wasn't what I really wanted, and I liked freedom better. And when CD Baby kind of happened, it seemed to bring me towards a much happier plan than I originally set out with.
Okay, and one of your precepts that spoke to me was, and you can say it better than I can, but it was something about follow it, Don't kill yourself chasing something when people aren't responding. Only follow the things that go. Can you express how you put that?
Yeah, the difference is that actually I've gotten a few emails since writing the book, so I'm going to make a distinction now here in this conversation that the book doesn't make. I say two different things in the book. One, there's a thing we already talked about, like taking 15 years to get better at singing, and I never stopped even though everybody told me I should quit. I said, I don't care, I'm going to keep doing this thing. And after 15 years, I proved everybody wrong and I made myself a success. But then there's the other side where somebody's pursuing a business. And the difference is whether you're doing this thing you're pursuing just for yourself and screw everyone else, or is it something that you're really doing for others? Like when you're doing a business, let's admit it, it has to be for others to be self-sustaining in some way. So if you're doing something for others and they're not responding with enthusiasm, like if you keep, say, doing this business and you're just getting a few customers and people are kind of shrugging over it and you're not getting a lot of attention, then my idea is don't keep persisting as is. I think so. A lot of us learn the wrong lesson about persistence. We think that I used to think that persistence was about just continuing to push, but then I learned the hard way that persistence is about persistently innovating and persistently inventing and persistently finding new ways to get to the goal that you want, not persistently pushing what's not working. So I think if you're setting out to do like a business idea and the world is not responding with enthusiasm, then that's feedback that what you're doing is not working and you need to do something else until you do get that kind of big enthusiastic response.
Right. So I know I had that my own experience when I got into training people to be coaches. I did a particular workshop and I got the most explosive, exciting reaction I'd ever gotten, and I just followed it, and as opposed to chasing something that may or may not ever respond. Now, just to set the stage for everyone, you started CD Baby just for yourself. You loved programming. It got you back into it. You had to set up a shopping cart and everything. And some friends asked to join. So I assume at the beginning you had virtually very few customers. And then what did it grow to? When you were leaving, how many musicians did you have selling records, music with you, and how many customers were you handling at a given time?
Well, by the time I left CD Baby 10 years after starting it, there were 250,000 musicians and about 2.5 million CD buying customers. And I had 85 employees and four warehouses, and it was a big, giant operation. It was honestly much bigger than I wanted it to be. I wanted it to be smaller. But you're right, the way that it started was with almost no one. And I think this is really important. I meet a lot of entrepreneurs now that email me with questions and asking for my feedback, which I'm happy to help with. But I notice a trend that a lot of them want to get huge right away. They say, hey, I've got this little idea. Here's my little idea. How do you think I can reach millions of people with this idea? And I always say, wait, back up. Like, first, just reach one person. Like, if your idea has merit, it will make one person happy. Like, I've never met a crowd. I don't know if there's such a thing. It's just individuals. So please somebody. And once you've made one person happy with what you're doing, then focus on the second person and make a second person happy and then meet a third. So that's kind of how CD Baby started. Really, it was me selling my CD just for me. And then one of my musician friends in New York City said, hey, man, do you think you could sell my CD through that thing? And I said, yeah, I guess so. I hadn't thought of it that way, but sure, I'll hook you up just as a favor to a friend. But then a second friend said, hey, I saw you hooked up Dave. Do you think you could do that for me too? I said, all right, just for you, Rachel, no problem. It was just me and a few of my friends. And then it kept growing, and then it was friends of friends. So it was never meant to be something that pleased millions of people. It was just me helping out a few friends. So it and grows really slowly. I mean, another common trend I see with a lot of entrepreneurs is that I get emails that are saying, like, hey, I launched my business a few months ago, and it's not huge yet. What am I doing wrong? And I think, oh, come on. Like, CD Baby didn't get big until, like, 4 years of, you know, 16-hour days of me doing this. And even after one full year, I was probably only earning, you know, 100 or 200 bucks a week just with the occasional order. So it takes time to grow these things.
Wow. Even after a year, that's all you were doing.
Yeah, I remember I started it kind of at the end of 2007, and one real milestone I remember is Thanksgiving 2008. I left for a week.
You mean 1998?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, wrong decade. So I started at the end of 1997. Yeah, then in 1998, after about a full year after I had started it, I remember I left for a whole week to go visit my mom in Colorado for Thanksgiving, and I was a little worried, like, okay, well, what if I get a lot of orders? So I asked a friend of mine I gave him the keys to my house and asked him to go log in and check for orders once a day. Came back after a week, and no, only one order had come in that whole week. So that was almost a year after I started. It was still just earning, you know, 100 or so a week. And yeah, these things kind of take time, but then it just snowballed, and then it just grew slowly, and Then, of course, 6 years into it, people say, wow, how'd you do that? You know.
Right. Well, you had some kind of a threshold, it sounds like, at 4 years. So were you doing stuff in the early years to SEO and bring people to your website as well as working on the website? Was that part of your work?
Not at all. In fact, it's a little weird thing to, because of the context I told you where it's like I was living my dream as a musician, mm-hmm. I honestly didn't want the business to grow. Like, it was one thing when it's like, you know, my friend Dave said, can you hook me up? And I said, okay, I hooked him up. And then another friend said, can you sell my CD too? And I said, okay. And then it was 4 or 5, and then it was 10. But I actively didn't want this to grow. I thought, God, this is really taking a lot of time away from my music. And I didn't want it to grow. So I never did any marketing. I never did any SEO or anything. I wasn't trying to bring people to my site. I was just trying to honor my favor to my friends and then to their friends and then to their friends. And but no,
why
I never
were
did
you working 16-hour days and all that? If
part of it was fascination. Like, I was just fascinated with the building the website. I thought it was fun learning PHP and MySQL mm-hmm. and HTML and craft, you know, doing that and just working into the night. Just thought it was interesting. And then, honestly, I was just trying to help my friends. I kind of felt I had an obligation to the people that had come in already to serve them right and make the site mm-hmm. do things that they needed it to do, like give them accounting records and show them where their customers are and fix the search engine and things like that. So it was really just me responding to need from my existing clients. And this mm-hmm. is, I guess this is a really important point. But 16 hours a day was just spent pleasing my existing clients with no effort spent on bringing in more clients, because it was 100% focused on just pleasing the people that were there already. And one thing mm-hmm. your existing customers will never tell you to do is to ignore them and go get more customers instead.
Right.
You know, they just want you to keep your attention on them. So I kept my full attention on my existing customers, but luckily I did it so well that then they went and told everybody that CD Baby was the place to be.
Mm-hmm. And what was it that made the difference that you exploded, like, in year 4?
Honestly, I think it was just a little bit like that tipping point idea that Malcolm Gladwell writes about.
Mm-hmm,
like, after
mm-hmm.
a certain point, once there are 2,000, then 4,000, then 5,000 musicians on the site, and then kind of then also, you know, in the year 2001 or so, between 2000 and 2002, there was like this explosion of this independent music movement where people finally realized that they didn't need a record deal to get their music out into the world. And it was actually more popularized by sites like mp3.com, which back in 1999, 2000, spent millions of dollars on advertising and venture capital and made a big business all about spreading independent music. So I think CD Baby was kind of taken along on that wave of this kind of revival of the focus on independent music.
Mm-hmm. Let me invite everybody to remember you can ask Derek questions by sending an email to bendeenphd@aol.com and put at least Derek, D-E-R-E-K, in all caps in the subject line in your name, and I'll get the question to him. Now, I'm in your book, and I'm looking at page 3, where you have a series of points or quotes that are really cool that seem like part of what you believe and part of what you've learned, and kind of your goal with the book is to take 10 years of 16-hour days and experience and put it where people can pick up the best part of it in an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a bargain. So when I look at this, one of the things that I'm kind of struck by is I have a relative who has a very successful auto supply store, I mean office supply business for the U.S. government, and he was very obsessive about doing a business plan before he got started, and really helped him a lot, he says. But your experience here is your business plan is moot. You don't know what people really want until you start doing it. Can you say more about that?
Sure. To be fair, with any of these things, you know, I tried to kind of smash them into one little quippy sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But what that one means is that when most people think of a business plan, I think they think of those kind of the spreadsheets and the 5-year projections, and well, by Q3,
mm-hmm.
by year three, our projected annual income will be this. And to me, that's just worth a rolling of the eyes when somebody claims to know what will happen in year three and year five and whatnot. I think as long as we know, if we were to call them business guesses, it would make a lot more sense. It would put it into the kind of the proper perspective to say, well, here's a guess at what might happen. But to call it a plan and think that you need to do this before you set out, I think holds back a lot of people from doing something that is worth doing. I think a lot of people have ideas that are very worth doing, but they think that they can't start a business until they've done all these giant 5-year projections and gotten an MBA and consulted with everybody and whatnot. So but on the other hand, to me, a business plan is something that really shouldn't take more than a minute or two to work out in your head. But if you have a simple idea and you think, here's a service or a product I would like to offer, and then you just do some quick calculations. You think, okay, how much would it cost for me to do that? Okay, well, let's see. For me to do that for each person would cost about $65. Okay, I better charge $100 for that because I want to make some profit. And then you think, well, no, hold on, but I might be forgetting some things, so let me just charge $120 just in case I'm forgetting some things, and that will also leave me some room to give people some discounts. I could probably keep my costs low if I distribute the workforce in this way, and I could probably this and that. And there you go. That's your business plan. You can just work it out in a couple minutes. It doesn't need to be something you get an MBA to do.
Mm-hmm. What kind of planning do you think somebody should do in turn? Well, let's say this. I know for a fact that a bunch of people that will be listening to this recording or on this call are either consultants or coaches, or they are becoming coaches. And how important is it for someone doing that, do you think, to think in terms of serving a niche? And if you were advising someone who told you, I'm not exactly sure what niche would be best, and I'm not sure if they would pay, and so on, what advice would you give people for thinking through how to find a niche and how to explore it?
Great question. I love that. The niche is so important. When I meet young entrepreneurs, for example, especially these days since the Social Network movie, so many people want to start some kind of social network website or some mobile apps that connect you to your friends, that tell you where your friends are and what they're buying or something. And there's so many people doing this kind of thing that I just think, God, you need an edge. You need a niche. You need some kind of angle to do something that nobody else is doing. Here's my favorite example. You kind of asked a two-part question. So first, if you don't mind, I'll just focus on the
part.
It fascinates me. NyQuil. NyQuil is my favorite example of this. And this was written about in a book called Positioning by Rees and Trout, spelled R-E-I-S and Trout, I think. Brilliant book. It's like 20 or 30 years old now, but still worth reading. They use this example of NyQuil, that before NyQuil came along, you could look at a shelf full of cold medicines and see 30 different cold medicines on the shelf and not know which one to go with. But then NyQuil so brilliantly looked at this and they said, okay, all that other stuff, that's for the daytime. Now we are the nighttime medicine. And just in that one positioning, they carved out, in my mind, they carved out half of the pie. It's like before, if you think of the typical pie chart, right? You think of a circle. Before NyQuil, it was split into 30 little slices across the whole pie. But as soon as NyQuil comes along and says, all those other guys are for the daytime, we're for night, it's like you take that whole sliced up pie and you move it over to one half. And now those 30 other medicines get to share one half of the pie called the daytime medicines, and NyQuil owns the nighttime medicine category. So, mm-hmm. say for musicians, my advice was, if you want to start a recording studio in New York City, there's already 100 recording studios in New York City. Don't just make another one. If you really want to run a recording studio in New York City, pick one thing, like say, our recording studio is called Drums for You, and all we do is drums. You can go to all those other guys if you want to record anything else, but when it comes to drums, come to us because we are the specialists. We know drums like nobody else. And there, now you've kind of carved out your niche. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs are scared to do that because it eliminates 90% of their potential customers.
Mm-hmm.
But you realize that by eliminating 90% of your potential customers, you so strongly attract yourself to that 10%. And honestly, if you think about it, even if you were to have, if any of us were to have 1% of the market, we'd be doing really well. So aiming for a niche is so much of a better strategy than trying to please everybody. Now the next thing you asked was about how to reach them or how to communicate with them or, I think that I just get very literal and blunt.
Or even, Derek, even how to evaluate because there are niches where people are ultimately not going to buy it.
Right,
it's not going to work. So part of it is researching that.
Exactly. It sounds simplistic, but I think that the forgotten simple idea out there is so many people try to figure out in advance, will people like my idea? And they go asking others, or they go asking me because I wrote a book, like, do you think people will like my idea? And honestly, my answer is always the same. Well, ask them. If somebody were to ask me, what do you think of my idea for a mobile photo sharing app to connect you with your friends, I think, well, I don't know. I've never used something like that, and I don't want to. I don't like to share photos with my friends, so I have no idea. But I'm sure there are people out there that do, so you need to ask them, not me. All I can really speak about is my own personal experience. And so when I built CD Baby, I was just trying to help my musician friends. That's it. And then as they brought in more friends, I was just trying to help them. And as they brought in their fans who were buying CDs and telling me things like, hey, I'm in Denmark, and I would appreciate it if you would ship the CDs without the plastic boxes. And I went, oh, interesting. I'd never thought about that. And it's something, usually it's like your real customers will tell you what they really want, much better than some kind of mentor or guru or advisor can. You just need to ask the real people that will actually be using your potential service or product. Just ask them, and their opinion is the only one that matters.
Right. Okay. Great. Here's a question from Dennis Daly. Derek, what are your thoughts on balancing the need to be creative with work, parenthesis, and products such as music CDs, parenthesis closed, and focus on the need to generate business to get your work out into the world?
Balancing business with creativity, I think, to me, some of the most effective forms of creativity are the ones that are just solving a problem. So to me, work and creativity are quite intertwined. I think, unfortunately, sometimes we think of them as such different things, like one part of work is me just slogging through these forms, and then creativity is Picasso. And how can I balance my life to get some Picasso time and some time slogging through these forms? But I think if you really intertwine the two, and it's like as you're slogging through the forms, you're thinking, like, how could I find a way to make this easier? How could I either eliminate these forms or find a way so I don't have to slog through them? And to me, it's like so many things that later get called creativity are actually just problem solving from somebody doing the actual work. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The second question was about getting your work out to the world? I'm sorry, could you tell me that one again?
I'm trying to understand this question. It seems almost like about being creative with work versus marketing. But he says, what are your thoughts on balancing the need to be creative with work and with focusing on the need to generate business and to get your work out into the world?
Okay. Even that, honestly, I think getting your work out into the world, I think leave your creative hat on. Again, if you don't mind me using the music example, a lot of musicians I knew, I got to observe a lot of music careers for 10 years, and a lot of brilliant musicians would be full of creativity at the moment they write the song, at the moment they record the song, they perform the song. They're full of creativity in those moments, even how they choose to record it, you know, say with a certain amount of distortion or effects or instrumentation. And then they, even in the design of the album, you know, the album art, the title, all of that is so creative. And as soon as it's done, it's like they stiffen up and they say, oh, I need to market this and promote this now. What's the proper way to market and promote it? And I think, proper way, come on, listen to yourself. Like, think of all that creativity that you've used so far. Like, continue in that approach. Like, I think that your marketing should be as creative as the music. So here's one tiny little example that people like is there was a band called Captain T that came to me in the early days and asked me to produce their record. So I produced the album for Captain T, and the album was hilarious. It was during the time when the X-Files was on the air, and they were kind of tapping into this whole, like, Roswell, New Mexico, Area 51, CIA government cover-up kind of mindset. And they made an album about this. It was very tongue-in-cheek. And the band leader called himself Captain T, and it was his stage name, and he was pretending to be fighting for the rights of the aliens to free them from Roswell. So it was this very, like, humorous, tongue-in-cheek album, and it was a blast to make, and we were laughing all the way through. And even the album cover is like a picture of an alien crucified with a dollar sign as a shadow, and it was all very silly and fun. So when it came time to promote it, at first we found ourselves kind of accidentally in that stiff mindset, like, okay, well, that's the creativity part, now we need to market this. But that only lasted about a day until I realized, like, wait, hold on, come on. Like, this was a blast to make. Let's keep that same spirit when promoting it. So here's what we did. We got a database of every college radio station in the Northeast U.S. Actually, I think maybe even the whole U.S. I think it was like 500 college radio stations. And got it into a database and did a mail merge so that each one had a personalized paper letter. This is, you know, back in those days where it was all physical CDs. So we printed out 500 paper letters with the person's contact info in the top left. And the letter went like this. It said, "Dear Mark," or whoever the person's name was, "you don't know me, but I live in the bushes behind your radio station. I've been here for 15 years, and your station has saved my life many times over. But now a man named Captain T found me the other day in the gutter, and he lifted me up by my shoes and held me above his head and told me about the cover-ups going on in Area 51 and about the aliens, and we need to fight for the freedom of life, for all forms of life, and you need to spread this message through your station, WKRT, so please spread the message," and signed with an illegible scribble. And then, I'm not kidding, we took each one of these 500 pages out into the garden, and we rubbed them in the dirt, crumpled them into a little ball, and then uncrumpled them a bit, stuck the CD in the middle, with a Captain T sticker in it, put it, and then he found these black mailing envelopes. So stuck it into a black envelope, and then the final touch is just the day before we were set to send these out to 500 radio stations, he found at a stationery store a red and white warning sticker that said, "Warning, confidential, do not open for any reason." And we sealed every package with that sticker. So now imagine that you are the guy working at the radio station, and every day you get, or let's say every week, you get 100 manila envelopes with packages of CDs all the same, and then you get this one that's in a black envelope that says, "Warning, do not open for any reason." And then you open it, and it's this dirty letter rubbed and, you know, crumpled up in dirt saying, "You don't know me, but I live in the bushes behind your station." And so to me, it's like this whole idea of don't separate creativity and business. Like, The world appreciates it so much when you keep business and creativity completely intertwined, and be weird and be different, and the world needs that and appreciates it. And honestly, I think the world rewards that with business. There are so many quirky things about CD Baby that were the reason that people loved us over places like Amazon or the 20 other competitors that were direct imitators of CD Baby, just didn't have our kind of quirk and humor and charm. And so many times that's what people loved.
How did that campaign work?
The end of the story. It was a huge success. His CD got played on 350 of those 500 stations.
Oh, my God.
Enough that he actually made the top 100 charts of PMJ magazine, something that people usually only get if they spend, you know, $100,000 on promotion. We got it just from that one single mailing. And years later, say like 5 years later, he told me that he was in New York City. He was at this club, CBGB's, on Broadway, and somebody came up to him and said, "Wait, are you Captain T?" And he said, "I am." And he said, "Oh, my God, I used to work at this radio station at the college. I remember that day that we got your package, too. That was amazing." And he actually remembered the whole package and the dirty letter and all of that. It's like, when did that happen? It's like, come on. So I think, all of us, even this is sometimes even an interview like this, I remind myself of the importance of completely intertwining the your creativity and business. It's
so needed. That was brilliant. Here is a question from Tal Leead, L-E-E-A-D, and it's kind of general. But, Derek, if I could ask, what do you think got CD Baby to the point that you could actually get investors to buy the business? Now, I would think that would be the big answer there.
It was cash flow, and also we definitely dominated a market. So when I started it, end of 1997, there was nobody doing anything like it. That's why I started it. But by 1999, especially 2000, 2001, there were so many companies doing the exact same thing. They basically looked at CD Baby and said, "We could do that, and we can do a better design than he does." And they imitated it exactly. And in fact, including one of them, during the dot-com boom, got a $25 million investment from AOL. Not a buyout, but just an investment from AOL. Invested $25 million in them. But by 2002, with the dot-com crash, they were all gone. And even my little competitors were gone by 2003. So by 2004, we were just completely – we were the only ones left, and there was just no way to compete. So because we had such a head start, it would just be kind of impossible for somebody to kind of come in and try to start yet another independent CD store for musicians after that. So,
what could they have offered that you weren't offering? I mean, how could they offer what could they offer a musician that you that would make them choose them over you? Like the music, as I understand it, the musicians loved you.
Yeah, so the only, there was one that came out later that had a different offer where they said that they keep no money up front and they only keep a percentage of sales. No, I'm sorry, it's backwards. They came along saying, "We keep 0% of your sales. If your music sells for $15.32, then you get $15.32 for that sale. We keep no percentage of the sale, but you do have to pay an upfront fee to be a part of this program." But it tapped into the psyche of musicians who always feel that they're going to sell, you know, 100 times more than they do. So, that was one of the only businesses that came along and, competed well against CD Baby. But even that was digital only. That wasn't the whole physical CD warehouse thing. I think the physical CD warehouse thing was just impossible to, compete for anybody short of say, Amazon. So anyway, I'm sorry, the direct answer to the question was really honestly, if you are carrying on with your business, and especially if it's cash flow positive and it's profitable, and if you're well known in your field, you're known as the number one or even two or three in your field, you will get calls from investors or competitors. The one thing, if whoever's asking this, if it sounds like they've got this on their mind, my one bit of advice, though, is when I decided to sell, I had a few offers out there, but I took one of the offers, but then I also contacted Amazon, who I always thought would be the ultimate choice to, to buy Feedy Baby. And I contacted them saying, hey, I'm about to sell my company here. I'm getting kind of close. I've got some offers, and I've almost accepted. But it wouldn't be fair for me to not give you guys a shot. So all of a sudden, Amazon instantly was in the game and making offers. So I think it really helps if you get any offer from somebody that wants to buy your company, make sure you take that offer and bring it around to your other competitors to let them know, because then, especially if you get more than one offering, then you can really get a better deal.
And why did you not go with Amazon?
In the end, Amazon was willing to offer more money than the other company, but as it got closer, I just realized that my legacy, or whatever you want to call it, mattered to me, that I wanted to make sure that my customers were in really good hands. And I realized Amazon doesn't have experience in dealing with musicians and the fragile egos and all of that kind of stuff, whereas the company Disc Makers that I had been working with for years, they had been dealing with my exact same clients for many years and had a lot of experience doing so. So in the end, I just kind of felt my clients would be in better hands with Disc Makers. Still a huge Amazon fan. In fact, they are the publisher of my new book. But I just felt that Disc Makers knew my clientele better.
And is CD Baby alive and well?
Yeah.
Prospering, doing okay?
From what I hear, I really kind of had to emotionally disconnect from it, the way if any of you have been through a divorce or even, let's say, moved out of a house. You know, it's kind of tough. You think of it as your house, and then the day that you move out, it's really... it's not your house anymore. Somebody else has moved in, and they paint it whatever color they want, and they knock down walls, and you just kind of have to emotionally disconnect. So honestly, I haven't even spoken to anybody from CD Baby in 3 years now.
Okay, here's a quick question from, I was talking to a colleague today. You couldn't be on the call, but wanted me to ask you a question. And basically, he runs a small training organization where they provide courses that are delivered virtually. And he's not at all happy with his website, and he's not happy with his you know, where they show up on Google and so on, and needs to redo it. And he said, when you look at MuckWorks, it's not an elaborate website at all. It's very simple and straightforward. That's not what my competitors' websites are like. If Derek were advising somebody like me on how to really get an effective website, what are the steps he might tell me to go through?
The biggest one is A/B testing. I'm such a huge fan of this. Because first, it fully embraces the philosophy of just saying, I don't know. I don't know what my customers will like. So for every change you make in design or price or whatever, there's so many different options out there, including Google has one built in, I think, where you can put up two different designs, and they are given to your every time a visitor comes to your site, they are sent through either the A design or the B design. And when I say design, I mean it can be different price offerings and wording or everything. And then you can measure the results on how many signups did we get this week through the A design versus the B design. And if the B design got a lot more signups, then that becomes the new design. And then you make that the new norm, and then you start testing from there. I'm such a huge fan of this, and there are so many great books about this. Like, if you go out there and just start to look for the subject of A/B testing, that's really all I can recommend, because it just lets your target audience decide with proof which design is more effective for them. Granted, it takes a certain quantity to make that happen. If you're only getting 4 or 5 visitors a day, it would be hard to measure. Maybe you'd have to let each test run for a month or something to see some real results. But once you've got any kind of quantity, though, I'm just such a huge fan of A/B testing.
And on MuckWorks, for example, and if you could tell the listeners what your new business is, and then I had a question to ask you about the website, but could you tell them why you got into that and what it is?
Sure. For 10 years of working with musicians, selling their music and focused only on that, the most common thing I would hear people say when I would talk to them about what they need help with is that they would often say that they needed someone to help them. I need a manager. I need a booking agent. And those are the two most common ones. I need a manager, I need a booking agent, or I need like a publicist promoter. But every time I would ask them, like, okay, well, what would a manager do for you? And they'd say, oh, you know, things like book us hotel rooms when we're on tour and take care of this and verify our gigs and copyright our songs and trademark the band name and update the MySpace page. And they would tell me all these things, and I would say, you know, that sounds more like an assistant than a manager. You know, a manager is somebody that you give them 50% of all your income because they're supposed to be such a brilliant strategist. All the things you just named are like, you need an assistant for that. And they'd say, oh, but I don't want to manage somebody and I don't know where to find an assistant and I don't like to take care of that. So Muckwork is really my answer to that. That's where the name come from. Muckwork, we do your dirty work. This idea that if I have a kind of a network of assistants that are trained to do all those things that musicians need help with in advance, then all a musician needs to come in and do, they don't need to manage or even delegate very well. All they need to do is, if at moments they're feeling overwhelmed, they could just come into Muckwork and say, yo, please take care of this for me. Here's my list of my upcoming 20 tour dates. Please verify the venues and make sure I have a hotel at each. Go. And that's all they need to do, and we'll just take care of everything. So that's the core idea of Muckwork. The site, so the business isn't launched yet. So when you look at muckwork.com.
Oh, it's not launched yet.
No, I'm sorry. It's not launched yet. So the day after I sold CD Baby, I got a good night's sleep that night. And then I'm so ambitious that the next morning I woke up and I started Muckwork. And I spent hours that day coding, and I spent the next few months working on it and started doing the programming, and I even hired somebody I thought would be a good first manager for it. And a few months into it, I realized that I was going to burn out hard if I didn't take a break in between the selling of CD Baby and the starting of my next company. I honestly had not taken any vacation time, and I worked 7 days a week, 16 hours a day for 10 years. And so I was really just continuing on that trajectory, and I had to force myself to stop. I realized, like, okay, hold on. If I don't stop now before starting Muckwork, then I'm going to be trapped in, and I'm going to get caught up in the obligation of running Muckwork, and I'll still never have any break. So, honestly, that's what the last 2 or 3 years of my life have been, is I stopped. I dissolved the corporation. I put the website on hold, basically like a coming soon or here's the idea, sign up if you're interested, and I'll let you know when it's ready kind of page. And I spent the last 2 years very deliberately changing my trajectory, or as I like to call it in my computer terms, I wanted to replace the operating system in my head. So that's when in the last few years, that's when I read about 80 books about psychology and business and philosophy, and I traveled, I learned to scuba dive in an Arctic lake in Iceland, I moved to New York City and met this great woman, and we got married, and then we traveled the world looking for a new country to call home, and that's why we chose Singapore. And
now, is Singapore going to be your permanent home, do you think?
Yep, it is.
Are you going to stay in Singapore?
Yeah, in fact,
Pardon?
So a few weeks ago, I got permanent resident status here, which is kind of the equivalent of the U.S. green card. So, yeah, I'm a permanent resident of Singapore now. It's home. I love it.
And this what do you love about it?
as we're speaking, by the way, I'm on the 51st floor of I have an apartment on the 51st floor of a 52-story building, and I'm looking out at the gorgeous skyline of the city over the bay with the little boats in the water. And the quality of life here is great, but more importantly, it's halfway in between India and China. It's right next to Indonesia, right next to places like Thailand and Cambodia, and Vietnam, and it, to me, it's just such a fascinating part of the world to be in the middle of. Like, you know, the way that I grew up in Chicago, then moved to New York, and then Portland, Oregon. When I lived in Chicago, if I get on a plane for 2 hours, I'm in Tennessee. But being in Singapore, if I get on a plane for 2 hours, I'm either in Thailand or Indonesia or Malaysia or Cambodia or Hong Kong, or even 3 hours and I'm in India or China, and 4 hours I'm in Japan. And it's just such an amazing place to call home base for the next decade or two. I just really love getting to know this part of the world. It's, I think it's very healthy for your brain also to not just get stuck in a rut in one way of doing things. And living here in Asia makes you challenge your assumptions on a almost daily.
Right, and you're even able to open a book that's very high on the Amazon bestseller list without doing a physical book tour and doing it all from Singapore.
Yeah, so, that was a nice challenge. Or even, honestly, talking with you right now, this is amazing that we're having this crystal clear conversation with me being on the other side of the world. I love this.
And you're doing this on Skype, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, it is a great connection. I've got so many questions here that, about
great.
Your book, which I really liked. And, you know, my feeling is for the price of this book, if it gave me one idea, it's worth it. And it's got so many more ideas than that. But parts of it upset me a little bit or pissed me off a tad. And
good.
One of them was the Steve Jobs story and how he just really seemed to have ripped you one way and then the other and then tossed you a bone at the end. And it would be great if you heard something from him when he reads the book or got some reaction at all, though I doubt it. But
I doubt it. But you know what? Honestly, the reason I was so excited about our conversation today, and I love your field. I love the field of positive psychology, and I love what you're doing. But maybe it's because this is kind of my natural disposition anyway, but
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of it also is when I was 19, somebody made me read Tony Robbins' book, Awaken the Giant Within, and there's this great question that he asked in there, or rather asked the reader to ask yourself often, which is this question about, like, what's great about this? So, honestly, and when that my experience with Steve Jobs and all that, and I won't retell the whole story, but it made me realize that never again to promise things that were out of my control. That sometimes we set up some kind of business or service that is actually completely dependent on another business. Think of, well, people that are doing Facebook games, for example. What if all of a sudden one day Facebook says, no more games? And all of a sudden the whole business is destroyed. So luckily, like, my business was not destroyed when Steve Jobs kind of like tossed me around his whims or whatever, but it was a great wake-up call that I needed to make sure that my future business was not too dependent on anyone and that I wasn't promising anything that was out of my control. So in the end, I didn't mind, and it made for a fun cocktail party story, and now it's told in a book, so there.
And just out of curiosity, you refunded the $200,000, did you ever get it back when you went ahead and went with it? My understanding was they paid you $40 a record and that you refunded all that.
Yeah, so I refunded all of it, and then it was the best $200,000 I've ever spent, because the goodwill that I got from that,
mm-hmm.
by telling 40,000 people that I'm refunding their money in full because I couldn't achieve
mm-hmm.
my promise, and then I went and achieved my promise to them anyway right afterwards, but for free now, that got such amazing word of mouth. Like, I don't know if you've heard those stories about, say, Nordstrom's department store,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
there are these legendary stories of Nordstrom's return policy. And this one in particular that they said, you know, that some guy bought a shirt at Sears, wore it for a few years, and then went to Nordstrom's to return it, and they gave him his money back. And so that story, whether it's true or not, spreads so well that it's almost like one story can tell more about the character of a company than all kinds of meaningless adjectives, you know, quality, service, and dependability. Me refunding everybody's $40 made this kind of everlasting legendary story that all of those musicians told their friends, and they said, you've got to go with this company, CD Baby. You know why? Do you know that they, this is a digital distribution? And they refunded my $40 because he couldn't hold the promise, and then a week later he did it anyway. So it just made this amazing story that just, I think, in fact, the business doubled in size in those few years right after that. So it was well worth it.
That makes a lot of sense to me. If I had been in your shoes, I would have asked him for the $40 back the next week. And what you did was much smarter than that. I once had a workshop in Houston canceled because of a lot of it because of a tornado or a hurricane or something. And mm-hmm. I refunded everybody's money and they loved it. Let's see. Many people on our list, virtually everybody, writes for the web, writes for newsletters, writes for blogs, and has websites. And you had, as I understand it, this kind of unusual experience of not just writing for the web, but writing for like 50, 100,000 customers, so that if you made even the slightest mistake, you paid a major price, and you learned a lesson from that. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, wow. That was boot camp. You know, they say that whenever the stakes are really high, you learn very well. I'll just tell the story. But because my mailing list, CD Baby, was 250,000 musicians and 2.5 million customers, that whenever I would send something out to them, if there was a single sentence that was unclear, I would get 50,000 replies asking what I mean by that, or this, they were confused, and then I'd have to reply to those 50,000 people individually now with the answer to the question that 50,000 people are asking. Or if I wrote the email and it was too long, say if I didn't mention something important until the sixth sentence, or worst case scenario, if it was 10 sentences down, then people would reply back. Like, say, I would say something like, you know, and to do this, to get your free thing, just click this link. But if that was 7 sentences down, I would get thousands of people replying back saying, great, how do I do it? And I'd have to reply back to a couple thousand people saying, please look at the original email, but the link is right there.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'd have to reply back saying, thanks for your email. Here is that link that you need right now.
Mm-hmm.
So what an awesome way. Talk about hard lessons learned. It was so painful if I was at all unclear. So I had to be absolutely clear and succinct and learn that I had to keep my emails down to basically 5 or 6 sentences for them to really be comprehended in full. And that was such great training. The reason I mention this in the book is that most people don't have mailing lists of a million people that teach them this the hard way. They
mm-hmm.
have websites. And I feel bad sometimes when somebody says, hey, Derek, can you check out my business and let me know what you think? And I look at their website, and it's full of this blah, 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 blah. We believe in quality and service and dependability, and we were founded in 1983, and we've been around for this, and we give you this service. And I think, oh, God, like, they haven't felt that pain, because when you have a website, you don't have 1,000 people, like, saying, I don't understand, the way that you
mm-hmm.
get from an email list, as I described. You just get apathy. And so people have these long, wordy websites, and then they say, hey, why aren't I getting a lot of traffic? It's like, well, people are just kind of, unfortunately, on the web, people don't reply back and complain. They just leave.
Mm-hmm.
So I highly recommend people kind of use their email list even more often than they're comfortable with, and write things and kind of hone that and try to get your message as ridiculously succinct as possible. I mean, I never could have predicted in advance that the ultimate length for an email to be comprehended with six sentences. But through trial and error, I found out that anything beyond six or seven sentences, they weren't really going to comprehend what you wrote. They were going to see the first few sentences and respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it might be the same thing with websites, that people read a lot less than we'd ever expect. And maybe our websites need to just have a few sentences of necessary text. And until somebody goes to that final step and says, yes, I really want to read that deeply about this, please give me lots of information now.
Okay, now something related that you've had a lot of experience with, I think many of the people on the call are involved, provide services to other people. They're basically like they are the service. And it strikes me that your videos are a wonderful way for people who have never met you in person to get a feel for what you're like, both responding to an interview or giving a talk or talking directly. And I suppose you can get more information on a video than you can on a six-line email. But how impactful have you found a video to be and set part A and part B for those of us on the call who have never done one? Any tips on how to get started and, you know, how to do your first one and, you know, what a good guide would be?
Well, I don't feel like an expert in that yet. Like, I honestly don't have that much advice. I barely just got started doing some videos. With this book, what I did is I thought it would be kind of fun. I know there are some people that are just more visual than reading.
Mm-hmm.
They prefer to watch a video or even listen to a podcast than to sit and read something. So I wanted to make animations for some of my essays from the book. Mm-hmm. So I went on – so here's my concrete advice. I went to Elance.com and Odesk.com, two websites that are good for freelance kind of groups of freelancers. And I put up a project just saying I'm looking for an animator, and you just let them bid on your project. So you don't have to say how much. You just give a price range. Like you say, okay, I can pay something between $500 and $2,000 or something, and let the animators bid. So I got a lot of bids. The funny thing is I got some that were from people saying, you know, we are based in New York City, and we can do this for you for $10,000, and then they would send me their videos – their example reels, and it was terrible stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got an email from a guy in the Philippines who said, I will do that for you for $400, and here's a sample of my work. And his work was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And then I tested him out by just hiring him to do just one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. It was even better than his sample work.
Wow.
And what was amazing to me is, like, he ended up doing all seven for me. I just finished – in fact, I just posted my seventh and final one last night. And he told me that – like, I asked him about if he'd be willing to do a lot more of these for me. And he said, you know, $400, he said, it may not sound a lot – like a lot to you, but he said, here in the Philippines, $400 is more than any of my friends make in a month. He said, the fact that I'm able to make $400 just doing one video for you that takes me about 10 days – he said, I'm rich. This is amazing. He said, in the fact, if you have 10 more videos for me, I can quit my job and do this full time. And I said, well, I've got lots more for you. So yes, let's do it. And, he's amazing. So if at the end of all of my videos, you'll see a little credit. He's got a website. It's plainlysimplestudios.com, and his name is Marvin, and he is just awesome. And not only that, but he knows some other brilliant animators. That I asked him, well, what happens if you get a lot of work out of this? And he says, I've got so many of my friends are also great animators, and they would love to work together with me, and so we can make a whole team of animators here. And it's really heartwarming to me that it's one thing for, you know, to be yet another client of a New York City firm charging $10,000, but to know that it's like to make an animation for something you're doing would not only make your product or service, like, that much cooler or more enticing, but it can also, like, totally make somebody's day in life.
Absolutely.
Somewhere, it's just, I love it.
Yeah, well, they're great. And for everybody listening, that you can find them on Derek's site, Sivers.com, and you can also find some of them.
Sivers.org, sorry.
I'm sorry, Sivers.org. Sivers.com is the takes you to the wrong place. Okay, I've got a question here from Linda Rowley, which is kind of specific, but Derek, when building a website for an existing business, how important would it be to develop a unique logo to be inviting to potential visitors?
I think a logo is quite important. It's the difference between by default, I'm very much a minimalist. So at one point in CD Baby's history in 2007, when I rewrote the software, I launched a very plain text version of CD Baby that was just as plain as can be. And I loved it because it was just lightning fast, no graphics. But immediately the user feedback was terrible, and people said, I thought I had accidentally typed in the wrong term, you know, when you accidentally go to the wrong page and whatever network solutions sends you to some kind of generic spam landing page where they try to get you to click on things. A lot of people said, I thought I had landed on the wrong kind of site because there was no graphics or nothing. So I think that it's very important, more than you'd expect, to get a really good graphically designed look and feel, including a logo that really looks like something, because it just signals to somebody that, okay, this is a real company. This isn't just a WordPress template. This isn't just somebody who dabbling in something this week and will change their mind next week. This is a real company because they have a logo. So, yes, I'm sorry, that's a very binary answer, but I think it's very important and worth paying for. In fact, there's a great company out there called 99designs.com that I just used recently because I heard great things about them. And yeah, it's wonderful. A bunch of freelance artists who are logo designers set up a profile on 99designs, and when you want to get a logo made, you just go to 99designs.com and you just describe what you want. And then dozens of designers will pitch for the job. They'll say, here's my past work, here's a rough draft of what I might suggest, and you get to pick the rough draft that you like the best and then work with that designer to make it just the way you want it and pay them when you're done, and it's a great service.
Okay, great idea. Quick question. You worked all these 16-hour days for 10 years, but you didn't have a family back then. And you fell in love in New York, and now you're living with your bride in Singapore. Is she in your line of work at all? Does she do something different?
Different but related. She is an educational writer. So part of the appeal, as soon as we met, I had already kind of felt one foot out the door at the U.S. Nothing against the U.S. at all. I'm still very American, as you can tell. But I turned 40 years old, and I was kind of feeling just adventurous. Like, okay, it's a big world out there, and I've lived in the U.S. for 40 years. I want to go live in the rest of the world for the rest of my life. And so I met this great girl, and so we had this second date. I was falling for her, but I didn't want to waste her time if she was very bound to New York. So on our second date, I said, how would you feel about leaving the U.S. and never coming back? I said, I really want to live the rest of my life in the rest of the world. She thought about it very deeply for a minute, and she said, yeah, I could do that. So she is an educational writer. She writes workbooks on school curriculums, and she can do that from anywhere. So she was already kind of she was working at Kaplan, the test prep company, when we met. And her, in fact, her whole division shut down just a few months before our wedding. So it was perfect timing that now we both just live the laptop life, and we spent this past year before we moved to Singapore, we were traveling the world, and we would kind of work from Brazil for a month and work from Sweden for a month and work from England for a month and just kind of testing out these countries to see which one we liked living in. So it's pretty amazing to have that laptop life.
It is. Two final quick questions. One is, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do it?
Email me right on my Sivers.org website. There's a link. I think it says contact me. And honestly, some of the coolest people I've met over the past couple of years are the people who contact me after an interview like this. And maybe it's just the nature of things where you've heard me blabbing for 90 minutes now, and it's like kind of it's been a kind of one-sided conversation for 90 minutes, and now if there's somebody on the other end who's actually listened all this way, I get the most wonderful emails from people, and I'm actually very wide open to that. And the funny thing is that people often start their emails by saying, I know you're incredibly busy, but I say, no, I'm not busy. I'm in control of my schedule, and I like leaving time for good conversations. So, yeah, anybody who would like to email me, please feel free to drop me an email. Just go to cdbaby.com. I'm sorry. Oops, old habit. Sorry. Just go to, go to sivers.org, sivers.org, and my email address is right there.
And last question, do you have any feel over the next 5 years or the next 5 weeks or whatever, but like what really are you excited about possibly doing or getting into? You know, what's going to be new for you?
Okay, right now I am loving learning Chinese. So Singapore is an English-speaking country, so English is the first language, but Chinese is second, and that's part of why I chose it, is that I've been learning Chinese casually for the last couple of years, and it's fascinating. And, you know, talk about the things that you never could have predicted. When I was making a living as a musician, I never could have predicted that I would have gotten fascinated with back-end computer programming of websites. I thought that I was just 100% music. And 2 years ago, I couldn't have predicted that I just love practicing my Chinese, like with the writing and those characters, and they have to go in a certain stroke order. I just get mesmerized. I just spend hours a day practicing and learning my Chinese. And so that's got my kind of hobby attention now. Business-wise, I'm really pursuing a pretty ambitious goal of being a paralleled entrepreneur. We hear about serial entrepreneurs who do one business and then the next and then the next. What I would really – my goal is to now set up a parallel entrepreneur structure where I'm just the guy in the middle, kind of like the holding company that will fund things and guide them and kind of help design them and mentor them, but that there will be six or so businesses running at once, all six of them very individual separate businesses, although all generally helping musicians in some way or another, but really be six different businesses, and I'll kind of be in the middle of all that, but they'll really be run by other people. So it's,
but you won't be putting in huge hours on any one of them.
Right. I'll probably still, I think by nature, I'm just that 16 hours a day kind of guy, because honestly, I've found what I love and I love to do it as much as I can. It doesn't feel like work, you know, of course. But yeah, the idea is spending a few hours a week with each one of the businesses, so that I will be more of a mentor than manager.
Okay, that's
so. That's my new goal. Those are the two things that are fascinating me the most right now.
Listen, I know it's Friday morning where you are, right? Am I right? Yes.
Yeah.
Friday morning. So have a thank you so much for coming and spending this time with us, and have a wonderful day and a wonderful weekend. And I'll be in touch soon.
Thanks, Ben. I really appreciate
okay.
it. Thank
okay,
everyone.
Take care. Bye bye.
Bye bye.